VOA, the science edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the science edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo. The global COVID-19 pandemic has officially entered its 16th month. In its recent weekly update on the disease, the World Health Organization reports that while the number of cases and deaths continue to decrease worldwide, they remain at high levels. Health officials are also expressing concern over the arrival and spread of variants that cause the coronavirus. At the same time, with the release of several COVID-19 vaccines, the number of people getting at least one dose continues to rise slowly but steadily. So far, more vaccines have been distributed in wealthy nations than in poorer ones. According to the White House, President Biden has announced that the United States will purchase and donate 500 million Pfizer vaccines that will be sent to 92 low to lower middle income countries and the African Union. After more than a year of living with government-imposed restrictions, many people are looking forward to life in a post-pandemic world. Today, we'll get an update on the coronavirus, talk about the mental and physical aspect of the crisis, and how we can prepare to resume our old routines. With us for the first of three segments on the pandemic is Dr. Lisa Marigakis, MD, MPH. She's the Senior Director of Infection Prevention at the Johns Hopkins Health System, Baltimore, Maryland. And she joins us today via Microsoft Teams. Dr. Marigakis, can you fill us in about the current status of the pandemic globally? What are we looking at regarding daily infections, hospitalizations, and deaths? Are we seeing any new surges?
You know, we're so grateful now to see that we have turned the corner, both in the United States and globally, seeing very encouraging trends finally in the right direction. And this is tremendous and probably due to several different factors, but we, of course, feel like the vaccine is a major driving force for getting the virus under control.
While the U.S. has nearly half its population receiving at least one vaccination dose, what about other parts of the world?
Well, we're so fortunate here in the United States to have so much vaccine availability and, as you say, to be nearing half of the population fully vaccinated. But that is unfortunately not true around the world and is something that we as a global community really need to address going forward and rather quickly, because it's to everyone's benefit to control viral transmission the world over. And that will help prevent variants from emerging. It will help save lives. So we really need to continue looking at equitable distribution and worldwide distribution of these vaccines.
To follow up on what you just said, I know there's been a push to get people vaccinated. Why is getting the currently offered vaccines so important?
Oh, it's tremendously important that everyone get vaccinated. It offers such great protection. This is really a miracle of science, if you will. The speed with which these vaccines were developed and the very high efficacy in protecting vaccinated individuals against severe forms of COVID-19. So there's no doubt that these vaccines save lives, and we just encourage everyone to become vaccinated as soon as you have the opportunity to do so.
Dr. Marigakis, you were talking about variants of the virus, and the CDC reports that multiple variants of the virus that causes COVID-19 have been documented in the United States and globally during this pandemic. So my question is, in developing the currently available vaccines, did the pharmaceutical companies keep this in mind when testing and releasing their vaccines?
To my knowledge, the pharmaceutical companies certainly have paid close attention to viral variants as they emerged. Of course, the vaccine development itself, however, began well before we started seeing the variants that are currently circulating. But it is, of course, very important in vaccine development to be aware that a virus may change over time. Many months went by in the pandemic where we didn't see those kinds of significant mutations. And then rather suddenly, it seemed that mutations started emerging really simultaneously around the world. And now we have a number of different variants that threaten our therapeutics and our vaccines. But so far, the current vaccines seem to be holding.
And speaking of that, Dr. Marigakis, I've read that Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna have already announced that they plan on having a booster COVID-19 shot ready for the fall. Do you see boosters as a way to consider vaccination against the variants, or will they basically boosting and extending the efficacy of the original vaccines?
You know, I think it'll probably, most likely, be a combination of both of those things. So we have really only had vaccines to administer to anyone for the last 6 or so months. And so we're still gathering data about how long the immunity after vaccination lasts. And so there is an open question out there about when we might need a booster in order to just rev the immune system up again and make sure that the immunity stays protective. So that's one reason we might need a booster. And then, as you say, we might also at that time wish to include components in the boosted vaccine that addressed the variants and these other versions of the virus. And that's similar to what we see with our annual influenza vaccine, for instance.
Here in the United States, public health officials are noticing a significant drop in new vaccinations after the tremendous rush for them back in January and February. Some who have received only the first of 2-shot vaccines are not going back for their second shot. How dangerous could this be?
For those who have gotten 1 shot, I'm thrilled that they crossed that bridge and decided to become vaccinated. So that's a good sign. That's the good news. But it is dangerous to skip the second shot. Absolutely. All of the studies that were done proving the efficacy of the 2-dose regimens involved people getting both of those doses. And so we really should follow the same dosing regimen that was studied in the trials. There is some protection that is afforded by the first shot in a 2-dose regimen, but you really lose out if you don't follow up and get that second shot. They designed it that way for a reason, and really to become fully vaccinated, you have to get the second shot.
What is the public health community doing to encourage people to become vaccinated or to get that second shot?
Oh, you know, it's such a challenge in so many different ways. This is the holy grail of public health. Vaccinations are one of the most powerful tools that we have to battle infectious diseases and prevent preventable death and serious illness from infectious diseases. So people are hesitant about vaccines for a variety of different reasons, and therefore our public health strategy has to match all of those different reasons and really meet people where they are, address their concerns, provide information and access to the vaccines, and it becomes increasingly difficult. At the beginning, we had a limited supply of vaccine, and really it was all about supply and demand. Now that we have more supply, it's more difficult reaching out to individuals and finding out what their concerns are and addressing those.
In getting people to get vaccinated who are hesitating at this point, it's interesting that a new poll from Harvard University finds that, at least here in the U.S., nearly half of the Americans don't trust the CDC and FDA. Your thoughts?
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, I think we live in an era where we have so much misinformation and distrust. It's a time when some have called the death of expertise, and a lot of criticism of government agencies like the CDC and the FDA, and also of experts who are offering recommendations and guidelines. I guess what I would say is that this pandemic has been an infectious disease threat unlike any that we have seen in the last 100 years. And there are so many people that are working in their areas of expertise to try to meet this threat and keep everyone as safe as possible. So I would hope that even when an agency or an expert says or does something that you don't personally agree with, that people would at least offer some degree of recognition that there's an effort to do this to save people's lives and to try to follow the guidance to protect themselves and those around them.
Dr. Marigakis, I don't know if you caught this or not, but in the May 18th edition of the Washington Post, they had an article saying that coronavirus vaccines may not work in some people. It's because of their underlying conditions. Can you explain what they're talking about?
Sure. With any vaccine, we know that there are some individuals that will not mount an immune response, and that vaccine won't confer the protection that it's intended to provide to that vaccine recipient. Sometimes we don't know why that happens, but there are groups of people who have underlying medical conditions that make it very difficult for their immune system to mount a response to a vaccine. And so that could be primarily a group of medical conditions called immunodeficiencies. And that could be because they have some problem with their immune system, or because their immune system has been diminished somewhat because of medications they're taking. Let's say they have an autoimmune disease or a different condition that's being treated with medications that modulate the immune system. So there's a variety of reasons that people, even after vaccination, might not be protected. And that's why it's so important that the rest of us get vaccinated to shut down the virus and protect those vulnerable individuals.
Local to national to international efforts are out to get rid of some of the health protocols that have been put into place by the pandemic. For example, masks. Is this the proper time to start normalizing life and move beyond pandemic thinking? Or is this premature, and is it due to political and economic pressure? It seems like we're getting mixed messages. On one hand, we're hearing about surges of infections in different places, and then we're being told we can take our mask off if we're vaccinated.
You know, it's one of the great ironies of this whole pandemic response that even when things are looking better and the viral numbers are going down and the trends are going in the right direction, people, have gotten upset, and we have had even more kind of agitation and a rush to opening up. I can certainly understand that now, as we have been at this for more than a year and everyone is tired and so anxious to get back to normal life. I guess what I would say is we have to remember that there's still a lot of vulnerable and susceptible individuals around us. And that varies from location to location, depending on the vaccination rates. But vaccination at its heart is a community or a group activity, because the vaccination protects individuals, but high levels of vaccination rate actually interrupt viral transmission and shut down the virus, protecting everyone. So that's the goal. And when you look at something like masks that have been so politicized and, you know, people push back against them, some people have refused to wear them and it's become political. But it's such a simple tool to interrupt viral transmission from person to person. And it really was a step that we took that the data showed worked until we had the vaccine. Now we have the vaccines. We just have to get everyone vaccinated or get our vaccination numbers up. And then it will certainly be safe to go back to much more normal life.
And finally, Dr. Maragakis, throughout the pandemic, we've heard public health officials talk about how important it is to achieve herd immunity. Can you tell us about herd immunity, and do you see herd immunity developing for COVID-19?
Well, herd immunity really refers to this concept we've discussed about getting the vaccination numbers up to a high enough level that the virus has a hard time finding a susceptible person. So one infected individual moving through society is much less likely to transmit the virus to others because there are ring-infected, vaccinated individuals around that person. Do I think we're at herd immunity? Not yet in the United States, certainly not in the world. But I do see us moving rapidly towards it, particularly in the United States and other countries that have had very successful vaccination campaigns and have sufficient supplies of vaccine. So now we need to look globally and make sure that everyone has that opportunity to become vaccinated. And then we will continue to move towards herd immunity and try to shut this virus down.
Dr. Lisa Maragakis, thank you so much for the update on COVID-19.
Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. Lisa Maragakis, MD, MPH, Senior Director of Infection Prevention at the Johns Hopkins Health System, Baltimore, Maryland. She joined us today via Microsoft Teams. You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I am Rick Pantaleo. Here's a reminder that Press Conference USA is available for free download from our website, voanews.com/press. PCUSA, and also from many streaming services such as Apple Podcasts. We also hope you'll check out our new Facebook page at VOA Current Affairs and our Twitter page at Carol Castiel VOA for alerts and program updates. Let's get back to the science edition of Press Conference USA. Today, we're talking about the COVID-19 pandemic. In this segment, we'll talk about the mental health aspect of the crisis and how we can prepare to resume our old routines. My guest for this segment via Microsoft Teams is Dr. Netta Gould, PhD. She's the Associate Director of the Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center Anxiety Disorders Clinic in Baltimore, Maryland. Dr. Gould, for more than a year now, the COVID-19 pandemic has taken a serious toll on all of us. While much has been said about its physical aspects, what mental, emotional effects have you seen throughout the pandemic?
I think that the impact has been broad in terms of the psychological impact. You know, there's been certainly an increase in just stress, exhaustion, burnout for many people, sleep disturbance. We're seeing a lot of anxiety and depression, trauma-related disorders, as well as increased substance use. Grief, I think, is a big one, and I use that term broadly. So not just the death of an acquaintance or a loved one, but just the loss of life as we knew it. And so I think that's impacted all of us in some capacity, and then the unfortunate consequence of increased suicide as well.
You had mentioned stressors, and I've been reading of mental health professionals comparing experiences of people during the pandemic as being similar to what soldiers returning from war face, post-traumatic stress syndrome, or PTSD. What are your thoughts? Are you seeing this in your work?
So yes, absolutely. Post-traumatic stress disorder is a stress-related disorder that occurs following a traumatic event, and we generally do think of this in the context of soldiers, but it really has a much broader definition and spectrum. And certainly the COVID pandemic and what many people have gone through would qualify as a traumatic event. And what that comprised of is some sort of anxiety, intrusive symptoms, hyperarousal related to their experience, avoidance of aspects of the trauma that may come back to them in some way. People try to avoid the thoughts, people try to avoid places and things that remind them of the trauma. And so we are certainly seeing this in various capacities in frontline workers as well as others.
Do you think people in general are ignoring the mental health issues tied in with the pandemic?
I think that it varies, but what I've seen and at our institution, I've really seen a broader awareness, which I think might be a silver lining of the pandemic, that people are becoming more aware of mental health issues as well as more willing to talk about them. So if there is a silver lining in my profession, that may be it.
Most of us have been in pretty much quarantine conditions over the past year. Some of us have been able to get out and go about their daily business, but all in all, we've been kind of locked down. What kind of effect will the current drive to loosen up restrictions and try to normalize things the best as possible, what kind of effect will it have on those of us who are so used to living an isolated pandemic life?
Yeah. So there is going to be a phase of readjustment. Absolutely. We're now left with making choices regarding what we feel comfortable with and what we don't feel comfortable with. We've had to do this in some capacity earlier in the pandemic, and it's pretty exhausting. I think that we'll see people having a hard time kind of reintegrating, whether it's back at work, whether it's socializing. So I think it's important to make a plan, kind of know what to expect and make the reintegration graded if possible. And also just to accept that this is going to be challenging and there's nothing wrong with experiencing anxiety around this. It's a big adjustment.
Even though we've seen how the pandemic has affected us individually, what kind of impact do you think it'll have on us as a society, not only short term, but long term as well?
So I think that, you know, this pandemic has and will really continue to reshape society. We're looking at a multi-tiered and multifactorial impact on society. So whether it's family and marital strain, so at the familial level, at the academic level on our youth, on the economic level with the financial loss and strain and loss of livelihood. So I think that it has an impact on the individual level. Of course, that has a ripple effect, but more broadly speaking, we're seeing just a complete reshaping of society.
Speaking of post-pandemic normal, do you think life will actually return to what we remember as normal? How do you see the post-pandemic world? What are some of the challenges many of us will face? And you mentioned a few of them earlier.
I think there will be some sense of normalcy, but I don't think everything will be back to how we remember it. And I think some of the challenges will depend on what we went through and what this year has looked like, and it's different for everyone. And so there'll be a broad spectrum. You know, some people might just have to make minor adjustments to their schedules, while others are really trying to rebuild their lives completely in some capacity. And so I think, as I mentioned, the grief, that's probably one common experience that we're all having. And again, the grief, we use that term broadly here. But how do we notice that and move forward from that grief? How do we rebuild wherever we are right now?
Do you think it would be a good idea for those of us who've been under the pandemic for the past year to give ourselves some kind of self-help mental health checkup? I mean, what are some of the danger signs we should be looking for as we emerge from our cocoons here and go back into society?
I think it's always a good idea to have some sort of gauge as to how you're doing from a mental health perspective, and also have others check in as well on us if we're having difficulty gauging how we're feeling. So we have somebody holding us accountable for our mental health checkup as well. I think what we're really looking for is difficulty functioning in daily life. So whatever symptoms you're experiencing, are they impairing? Are they getting in the way of your work or social interactions, whatever they may look like? We're looking for using excessive drugs or alcohol to deal with these mental health symptoms, and just frequently feeling overwhelmed. So excessive anxiety, prolonged sadness, and of course, any thoughts of suicide. These are times where we want to seek additional help.
Dr. Netta Gould, I want to thank you so much for joining us today to help us check into the mental and emotional scars left over from the COVID-19 pandemic.
My pleasure, Rick. Thanks so much for having me.
That was Dr. Netta Gould, PhD, the Associate Director of the Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center Anxiety Disorders Clinic in Baltimore, Maryland. In our final segment, we're going to focus on the mental, emotional health needs of our children. My guest for this segment of today's program is Dr. Carissa Parrish, PhD. She's co-director of pediatric medical psychology at the Johns Hopkins Children's Center in Baltimore, Maryland. She also joins us today via Microsoft Teams. Dr. Parrish, can you share your thoughts on the importance of addressing children, adolescents' mental and emotional needs during this pandemic?
So we know that even under non-pandemic circumstances, kids have emotional and mental needs that sometimes go unrecognized. And I think the pandemic has really highlighted the ways in which kids have psychological needs just like adults do. And one need in particular that kids have that I think we as adults would say we have as well is the need to be with our friends and socialize, engage in structured and unstructured social activities. And the pandemic necessitating social distancing and isolation from social activities has taken a pretty heavy toll on kids and teenagers. The second thing I would say is one of my teenagers told me she did not realize how much she had missed being in person in school until she started going back in a hybrid format just in the last few weeks. And I said, you know, I think part of this is the invisible structure that helps us kind of deal with stress or kind of like regulate our moods throughout the day. We don't notice until it's gone.
So can you break down some of the needs and issues brought on by the pandemic by specific age groups? For example, early childhood, adolescence. Are there any age-specific issues that children are facing?
Thinking about it across different developmental stages, we could see that there might be some issues that would be less problematic for older kids compared to younger kids. But even those differences across age could vary between kids within the same age group. So for one example, learning in a remote format over the computer and dealing with technology or remembering how to use certain programs on the computer may be easier for teenagers because by virtue of their age and time using electronic devices. So they may have a easier time or be more adept at managing technology than first graders, for example. On the other hand, there could still be kids with learning differences or attention-based problems, where being self-directed for most of the day while parents are working would still continue to pose problems for teenagers as well. I think one of the big difficulties, if we start with our youngest, kids is that learning on the computer is very difficult for young kids. And research conducted by the American Psychological Association, they've conducted these helpful surveys called Stress in America at intervals throughout the year and have been doing so for several years. And they highlighted that parent stress is highest among our parents with youngest kids, so around the 5 to 7, so like kindergarten to second grade age. And I think a lot of this is because of that developmental mismatch between how we've tried to balance the public health needs of keeping folks isolated at home and in that remote learning environment for kids versus what's developmentally optimal for young kids. So we might see more restlessness or kind of difficulties with following directions in our younger kids. But I think for our kids in middle childhood, so upper elementary and middle school years, and then up into our teenagers and young adults, we've seen a rise in things like anxiety symptoms, depressive symptoms. Some reports have shown that there's been an increased utilization or number of visits per month in emergency rooms for mental health or behavioral health problems across childhood and adolescence. We kind of have a national shortage anyway for psychiatric inpatient hospitalization bed availability. And so having an increasing mental health crisis among our youngest citizens has been very difficult to manage.
Did the COVID-19 pandemic bring about any changes in your approach to treating children, adolescents?
Well, I guess the most obvious change is pivoting from in-person visits to telehealth visits over video. So we had done very few in our institution for mental health visits, and with a moment's notice, basically switched within a week or so to doing mostly telehealth visits. So that was the most significant change that we're still, you know, working through. I think for a lot of kids who have been functioning very well, started to have problems that were more reminiscent of when they were much younger. So difficulties completing assignments, being in class, so to speak, on the computer on time, navigating between different computer-based applications did cause a lot of academic problems that then exacerbated emotional and behavioral problems. And then more in our teenager group, some of this is like similar to what we normally see, but now focused on maybe a different content. So I recall having a lot of conversations and kind of disagreements being observed between teenagers and their parents around what's safe for me to do during the pandemic and personal freedoms versus like the greater good of the family or the greater good of the community, most of which are normal developmental kind of milestones that everyone works through in different ways, but they were really concentrated in this unique context of the pandemic.
Dr. Parrish, for parents and loved ones of children and adolescents, what can they do to support their youngsters to resume life in a post-pandemic world?
I'm reminded of what we as parents and teachers do typically in August every year of helping our kids transition from summer mode to school mode, where things may have gotten a lot more lax in the summertime with bedtime or meal times or screen time, things like that, where we kind of shift them in those last few weeks leading up to the start of typical school in the fall, of kind of regulating ourselves in anticipation of being back on a structured routine. One of the things that we've seen during the pandemic that seems to be a predictor of declining or deteriorating behavioral or emotional health is the loss in structured routines. And so I feel like the pandemic has been a poignant reminder of how important having structure and routines are. I think all of us benefit from that quite a deal, and it can kind of slip away from us invisibly until it's lost and we have to reinstate it. And so I think this is a call to go back to our basics of trying to catch our kids being good and trying to give them validation and appreciation in specific ways when we see them working hard and trying hard to kind of keep their emotional energy up for doing the next hard thing.
Dr. Carissa Parrish, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Carissa Parrish, PhD, co-director of pediatric medical psychology at the Johns Hopkins Children's Center. I'd like to thank Dr. Parrish and my other guests who took the time to talk with me today. Dr. Lisa Maragakis, MD, MPH, Senior Director of Infection Prevention at the Johns Hopkins Health System, and Dr. Netta Gould, PhD, Associate Director of the Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center Anxiety Disorders Clinic, all in Baltimore, Maryland. Today's guests join me via Microsoft Teams. And that's all the time we have for this science edition of Press Conference USA. Thanks for listening to today's program. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to be sure to join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.